the season. We have an almost full schedule through May. Here are the next talks for February, March, and half of April. The talk on the next week is Anthony Valentini on inflation and foundation economy mechanics. Then we have a special guest that we're waiting for confirmation of. Do we have confirmation?
No.
No. Okay. Then we have, we have then two talks in high energy astrophysics, TEV, gamma ray astrophysics in February 15th and March 1st, high energy neutrino astronomy and astrophysics. And between them, Vicky Nair, who's going to tell us how 2 plus 1 quantum gravity was solved, which is work that some of us are very excited about. And then it continues. But today we're extremely happy to have Laura Bottis from the University of Florida to talk to us about dark matter searches. She came from Heidelberg and then Stanford and now is on faculty at the University of Florida and is shortly going on to even greater things. And we look forward to her talk.
Thank you very much. And you can switch off to this line. Just because I think the image would, yeah. So I'll be talking about searches for cold relics of the early universe. Okay. So this is what I call the cosmic food chain. As I'm sure all of you are well aware, in the last 10 years or so, a wealth of cosmological data gave us this, what we call now a pretty consistent picture of the universe. We'll see what the problems are with it, but we think that we know, okay, that about 4% or so of the matter energy content of the universe is made out of ordinary matter, of which only 0.4% are stars, hot cold gas, people, and whatever. Most of it is probably in some intergalactic gas. Then about 23% is in what we call dark matter, you see, cold dark matter, okay, that is stuff that's clumped and that helped form the structures that we see today. And most of it is what is called dark energy and could be a cosmological constant, but we don't really have a clue on what it really is. So what I'm going to cover today is this part here, the humble 23%. Now, let's just review in a couple of slides why we believe we have dark matter. And I'm not going to give you a full account because I would need probably a couple of days only for this. But anyway, so we have dark matter in galaxies. That's important because we are in a galaxy. That's where we want to look for it. And as you know, the star up here in the central region where the mass grows like this, If you plot the velocity as a function of the orbital radius, you expect an increase, like in our planetary system, for instance. But if you go further and further out, okay, if all the mass is concentrated, say, in the visible part of the galaxy, then you expect the rotation curve to fall, okay, like with 1 over square root of r here. So that's what you expect if you measure rotation curves of galaxies. And as I'm sure you know, this is not what you measure. And thousands of galaxies have been mapped to these days. And you measure what I call this flat rotation curve, namely that the rotation velocity is constant as far out as you can look. That implies that there's about 10 more matter in galaxies that can be directly seen. And we have evidence, as I said, from thousands and thousands of galaxies. We have something that's called URC. Universal rotation curve, where you can explain these rotation curves of galaxies by having only one parameter, which is based on their luminosity. So let's move on to dark matter in clusters. First observation by Fritz Zwicky in 1933. Nobody believed him back then, and if you look at this guy, you may know why. So the velocity dispersion, he measured the velocity dispersion of galaxies here in the coma cluster, and by applying the Virial theorem, okay, so he measured, say, R and V, the velocity, you can infer what a mass is. If you assume that your cluster is in a equilibrium. And for a coma cluster, for instance, what's mostly measured are these mass over light ratios. This ratio turned out to be 300 times the one of the sun. Now, apart from using this method, that, by the way, is still used today as well, we have other methods to infer the mass of clusters. And one of it is to study the X-ray emission. Okay. You know, we have the intra-cluster space, if you want, is filled with this hot X-ray emitting gas. And by assuming that this gas, you know, is bound by the gravitational potential, you can actually infer how much mass needs to be there. Okay, so this is, for instance, an optical image of the Hydra A, and this is an X-ray image where you actually see this X-ray. And from Chandra observations, for instance, you get this ratio, and then we know what omega baryon is from Big Bang nucleosynthesis, and then you can infer the omega matter about a third or so. Okay. And again, we have mapped, well, not thousands of clusters, but several ones. And then there's a third method, which is totally independent of the former two, and amazingly gives the same result. Okay, so you look at the mass of the cluster by looking at the gravitational lensing effect. Okay, so as you know, the light propagates along these geodesics, which will deviate from straight lines when passing intense gravitational fields, and now you can observe how the image of background objects will be distorted, okay, by this mass of the cluster that's in the foreground, if you want. And from these images, you can then infer, you can reconstruct what is the mass of your cluster. For example, you can see here one such reconstruction, and you have all these spikes here that are the individual galaxies, but as you can see, the underlying mass distribution is much, much larger. Now, I won't be talking about this, but as you know, on cosmological states, for instance, we can only if you want, explain or simulate with this and body simulation, the structure formation. These are actually that map observations. This is one observation. We have newer ones from 2DF and from Sloan Digital Sky Survey and so on. If you assume that the universe that the matter in the universe is actually dominated by dark matter. Okay, otherwise there's no way that we can get a distribution that looks anything like the data. And also WMAP that measures the geometry of the universe, if you want, and gives us an independent measure of omega total. Okay. Now, in terms of looking at or searching for dark matter with experiments, our experiments are in the Milky Way, if you want, on Earth, so we need to know what is the local dark matter density, right? And where do we know this from? Well, we can measure the rotation curve of our galaxy. Obviously, because we are in the galaxy, it is not as well measured as you can see here, especially if you go further out as for other galaxies. However, it does stay flat up to large distances, and it is explained as well by a bulge here, a disk, and also a dark halo. Okay, so there's some uncertainty in here, and if you want, an acceptable range for the local density of dark matter is somewhere in here, 0.2 to 0.8 GeV per cubic centimeter. So as you can see, that's quite uncertain. And one of the goals of these dark matter experiments is to pin down this number. And not just the number, but to actually look at the distribution of dark matter, hopefully. Now, apart from this, of course, there's also motivation from particle physics that's totally independent. So as we all know, the standard model is very successful, but it's not complete. There is one experimental evidence, namely that neutrinos most likely have mass because they change flavor. And then standard model has a series of theoretical problems, if you want. And as we'll see later, we do expect new physics at the weak scale. Okay. We don't really know what it is. We have several ideas, but there must be something new there. And some popular extensions, and there are many others, is our supersymmetry. I talked a little bit only about it in one slide that relates bosons and fermions and gives us a nice dark matter candidate in terms of the neutralino or the lightest supersymmetric particle. And also theories with extra dimensions, as you see, where where a good dark matter candidate is the first Kaluza-Klein excitation, for instance, of the photon. Could be also of the neutrino, but it has been ruled out by not observing it in these direct detection experiments. But I come back to that a little later. So now let's go back and not assume that this dark matter particle is a certain comes from a certain particle physics model, but look at the more generic candidate that's called Wink, weakly interacting massive particle, and let's assume it existed in the early universe. So you all know this this argument, namely early on when the universe was hot, then these particles were in equilibrium with the rest of the soup, and you had these reactions here going back and forth, and that happened as long as the reaction rate here was larger than the expansion rate, right? So, but then as the universe expands and cools, then this reaction rate drops basically below the expansion rate, and if equilibrium here were the entire story, you would end up on this line with no dark matter candidates at all. However, because this happens, at some point, and it depends on the cross-section, on the annihilation cross-section, we say that the particle is freezing out, and we are left with a relic density. Okay. Now, this relic density, if you calculate it, you will see that it's inversely proportional to the annihilation cross-section. And now, if you say, okay, I want the dark matter, what we observe, say with WMAP and all the other cosmological observations, to be around 0.2, and you plug that in here, then you get cross-sections of the order of 1 picobar, so weak cross-sections. Okay? And on dimensional arguments here, if you write down to what masses would correspond, then you get masses from 10 GeV to a TeV or so. So masses of the order of the weak scale. Now, the question is, of course, is it just a coincidence, or does it tell us something deeper? And what we think it tells us is that the fact that this relic density and mass, they do point to the weak scale. Okay. And perhaps this new physics that's responsible for a weak symmetry breaking will give us a dark matter candidate, such a WIMP. Okay. And the nice thing about this candidate is that it can be explored in astrophysics experiments and also in accelerators. Now, there are lots of other dark matter candidates I won't talk about. I like, and not just me, but lots of people there like this one because of exactly all of these arguments here. Okay. So it's testable. Now, let's go back to see what candidates we have for WIMPs. As I said, supersymmetry, if standard model particle gets a superpartner that differs in spin by 1/2, has the same quantum numbers, to prevent rapid proton decay, we have this discrete symmetry that's imposed. R parity, which is +1, it's a multiplicative quantum number, +1 for standard model, -1 for SUSY particles. That means that particles can only decay into an odd number of particles, okay? That also means that the lightest supersymmetric particle is stable. And most of the time is a linear combination of the Bino, Bino, and the two neutral Higgs Zenos. Another nice example for a WIMP, for a weakly interacting massive particle, comes from these theories with universal extra dimensions, where all the standard model particles propagate into flat extra dimensions at the weak scale somewhere, okay, 1 over r, which is the size, if you want, of these extra dimensions about a TeV. What you get here, and that's been said already by Kaluza-Klein in 1921 or so, for each standard model particle, you get an infinite power of partner states with the same quantum numbers, okay, and their mass square is proportional to this here, where n0 are the standard model particles, and from basically conservation of momentum and then translation invariance along the extra dimension, you get a discrete symmetry. You don't really you can show that actually Kaluza-Klein number is not conserved, but what is conserved, it is this discrete symmetry that's called Kaluza-Klein parity. Okay? That also means that the lightest KK mode here cannot decay into a standard model particle and is stable. And it has been shown by several people in the field that this is an excellent dark matter candidate as well. Okay, so now let's go to how we actually look for these particles. Okay, at this point, as we see, we have no way of actually saying if you do detect a particle in a direct detect experiment, whether it comes from supersymmetry or extra dimensions or so. But hopefully one day we will be able to say that. Now, 10^6 per second go through your thumb without you noticing them at this time. 10^15 through a human body, but very few will interact. So the question is, if they have such weak interactions, how can we actually detect them? So we can make them in accelerators. Okay, this is what happened in the early universe, where we had an inhalation of these dark matter particles, if you want, into quark, antiquark, and other fermion, antifermion pairs. So by crossing symmetry, you can also hope to produce these particles, and that's exactly one of the aims of future experiments of the LHC and also of the Tevatron. You can look at the sun's core or the galactic center or in the halo, namely look for annihilation products of this particle. Okay. If it did annihilate in the early universe, it may still annihilate today if the density is high enough, so you will have to look at regions where these particles accumulate and build up a density so that you have visible signal there. And we'll talk a little about these experiments later. Or you can go to Minnesota, for instance, and look at the scatters of these particles of normal matter. Okay? Again, by crossing symmetry, they will scatter off quarks. As you see, this is not a very likely process. The cross sections are very small. However, it can happen. And why you go down old mines or you go to underground laboratories? Because you want to get rid of the cosmic rays, right? That would induce a signal that's millions of times higher than what you're actually looking for. So very simple schematic here of direct limb detection, okay? Let's say every liter of space contains about 10 to 100 WIMPs that are moving very slowly. Okay? They are in the same gravitational potential as the rest of the stuff, the sun, and so on. And the rate of scatter with nuclei, okay, WIMP comes, will scatter with the nuclei. The rate is proportional to the number of target nuclei in your detector times the local WIMP density over mx times the scattering cross-section. Now, you can write down the effective Lagrangian if you have a particle physics model for your WIMP, okay? And because these particles move very slowly, your elastic scattering will happen in the extreme non-relativistic limit, and what's left as an effective interaction are spin-spin interactions where the spin of this unknown particle couples to the spin of your nuclei, if they have spin, and scalar interaction, where it actually couples to the mass, okay, of your nucleus. And the event rate, as I said, will depend on the local WIMP density, so that's what I want to know, and on the nucleus, so you have to solve the nuclear physics there that's involved. And you can write the event rate, so this is what you will actually measure in a detector that looks something like that. If you assume, you have to assume a certain velocity distribution of these particles in the halo. Okay? And what's mostly assumed is a Maxwellian-Boltzmann velocity distribution. This seems to be quite maybe the case. We don't really know what the distribution is, but however, it doesn't seem to be such a bad model if you look at these the simulations, okay, and body simulations. There is, as we see, there is a it's pretty unclear how the dark matter is distributed in the center of the galaxy, okay, whether we have a spike there or whether the distribution is flat and so on. However, if you go to the outermost parts, then we think we know pretty well how it looks like. And You also have a form factor here that we need to take into account. Now, the energy that's transferred to the nucleus, you can calculate it. This is the reduced mass between your WIMP and your nucleus, the velocity here, mass of your nucleus, so it's pretty small. It's mostly below, actually, 50 kV or so. Now, just to give you an idea of what we are looking for, I've plotted here different materials that I use as detectors for WIMPs. For instance, germanium, neon, and xenon. And this is what a spectrum would look like in your detector. Okay, you have here the recoil energy, and these are what we call DRU, differential rate unit, tons per kilogram kV and day. And you have the suppression here at higher recoil energies because of this form factor. Okay, that's simply the Fourier transform of your nucleon density. And the heavier your nucleus, for instance here for iodine or xenon, the stronger the suppression will be. Okay, so you have you will expect a higher event rate here at low recoil energies. However, if you go to higher energies, then your event rate drops dramatically. So what's important then for these detectors, as you can see already, it's a very, very low energy threshold, okay? So a few kV. Because otherwise, if your energy threshold is high, of course, you will miss most of the signal.
So is the idea to measure the recoil or spin products or spin direction? What is the point? What is exactly the
spin? Yeah, you measure the recoil. Yes, exactly. That's
how,
what.
How do you know it's not something else?
Right, that's a good question. We'll talk about this later. Yeah, it can be lots of other stuff. But let me, I actually mention this right now. So there are, it's a very exciting and very active field, I would say. There are lots of experiments out there, and I will present only very few. But however, the techniques, or say some of the techniques to measure this recoil energy, are to have a detector, then convert it into something, into a signal that you can actually read out, for instance, into phonons, or into light, or into charge, okay? Now, as you said, there are lots of other things there, lots of other particles that can give you a very, or the same signal, a recoil, that can recoil off your nucleus, okay, for instance, neutrons. Well, it turns out that if you have a clever detector and measure two of these, observables, phonons and light, or phonons and charge, or charge and light, then the ratio of these two will actually tell you what type of recoil it was. Okay, it will identify the particle. It will tell you whether the interaction was due to photons or electrons, or WIMPs or neutrons. Now this already tells you that you have no way by this method to tell between a WIMP and a neutron in a certain energy range, few MeVs or so. As we see, we can shield against those neutrons. So this is what I call the worldwide WIMP search. You have several experiments. Probably you know this one here, at least, in Canada, Picasso. And there are several underground laboratories, a big one here in Italy, the Gran Sasso, where there are several dark matter experiments, Camp Frank, Bobby Mine, NUSO, that hasn't actually been built yet. But it just gives you an idea. Now, where do we stand? So if you look at this, I will show you this plot a lot, or a similar one. So what we plot here, we plot the predicted cross-section, okay, normalized per nucleon as a function of the WIMP mass here, okay? And this cross-section and the mass is not known. We'd like to say, okay, the cross-section is somewhere here and the mass is here, so we have to look for this Poynting parameter space, but that's not the case. And these are some of the theoretical predictions here in yellow and gray that come from supersymmetric models. And these curves here show only limits by the Direct Detection experiment. So everything that's above such a curve is excluded. And this is where the field was in 98 or so when I started with dark matter, I believe. So everything above this was excluded, and this is where we are now in 2005, okay? The good news is, of course, that we have advanced and we are starting to test predicted parameter space. The bad news is we don't have evidence for a signal. In fact, there is one experiment in Italy, the DAMA experiment, that's probably famous, and I don't need to explain it, that they have they still have evidence. I think they claim at the Six Sigma level or so that they see a dark matter signal. Unfortunately, it's the only experiment that has such a claim, and none of the others that we'll talk about could confirm it. Yeah.
Question, right. are you going to come back later to the same kind of graph?
Yes, but if you want to, yeah, I will ask, yeah, I will come back.
So what is the yellow, the yellow?
Well, the yellow here is volcano, and they have a certain supersymmetric model, volcano et al., okay, where, you mean this one?
So okay. I guess the question is how far...
How far it goes down. Yes, I will show you. Yeah, we will go down by many orders of magnitude. It's bottomless, I can tell you already. So, now, okay, so there are lots of experiments, and there are lots of experiments in between here. These are the best ones so far. CDMS leading the field here by at least a factor of 10 or so. Then this is an experiment called Zeppelin, and this is an experiment called Edelweiss. And because the best results now come from these cryogenic experiments, I'm going to tell you a little bit about these. Cryogenic experiments are so-called phonon-mediated detectors. So what they detect is they detect the thermal or the fast phonons after wind scatters in an absorber. So say this is your absorber, then you have here a temperature sensor that's coupled to a reservoir here at a certain temperature, that's mostly your dilution refrigerator. So a wind comes in, and a deposited energy will create a temperature rise, basically, of your absorber, okay? And this temperature rise is something that you can measure, okay? So it follows this relationship here, where this is the heat capacity, and this is the thermal conductance link between this absorber and the reservoir. Now, as you probably remember from your undergraduate years or so, if you have a pure dielectric crystal or a superconductor below the critical temperature, then you have this Debye law here, that C of T, the heat capacity goes with T to the third power, right? So that means that the lower the temperature, the larger this delta T per unit of absorbed energy. So you need to go to millikelvin or so in order to measure a temperature rise, of a few microkelvins. And you can do that, okay? Now, how can you do that? Well, there are several ways, and one method that the CDMS experiment is using are these transition edge sensors with electrothermal feedback. So again, you have here your absorber and your temperature sink, and then you have a thin film. This film is very thin, nanometers or so, of a superconducting film at the surface, and you apply a certain voltage across this, okay? So you will have equilibrium once ohmic heating will be balanced by the heat flow into your absorber. And let's say now an excitation that was created in your absorber, phonons, will hit the transition edge sensor. What will happen? The resistance will increase, then the current is decreasing, okay, because the voltage is kept constant, and the Joule power is decreasing as well, okay? Then you will get this feedback signal, because as I said, the voltage, the bias voltage has to be constant, namely, you will get a change in Joule power heating up the film, right? So basically what you measure is you measure the deposited energy, you measure this delta I there, okay? The voltage bias is constant, or the integral over time. And now by choosing both the voltage and the film resistivity properly, you can operate stably here in the steep portion of the transition edge, okay? So you have here the superconducting regime, and this is the normal conducting regime, and you want something that has a very steep transition here. And as I said, you have this electrothermal feedback, so you're measuring this delta E over time, and because you have that will give you a very fast response, okay? That's about 100 times faster than thermal relaxation time. So there are other ways of measuring the thermal pulse, namely by looking at the phonon signal after it actually has thermalized. I'll show you an example when we talk about CDMS. Now, the CMS experiment is at the Sudan Lab in Minnesota. Here, there's muon intensity as a function of depth. We always give these depths in terms of meter watt equivalent to how many meter watt it would correspond. And these are some of the underground labs out there. So Sudan is not a particularly deep lab. It's about 2,000 meter watt equivalent. However, the experiment before that was at the Stanford underground facility, where we had a neutron flux of about 1 per kilogram per day, and that was reduced to 1 per kilogram per year. So neutrons in this game are your ultimate background, because as I said, they will induce nuclear recoils that look exactly like a WIMP. Okay. However, if you have, as in the case of CDMS, if you have two different materials, your WIMP spectrum scales with A square, while for the neutrons, that's not the case. So if you have two different materials, you can actually measure what is the neutron rate versus the WIMP rate. Neutrons will also multiply scatter. So if you have a detector that has a high granularity, or you have several small detectors, then you can measure the neutron flux by looking at multiple interactions in detectors. While the WIMP, of course, the cross-section is so low that it will only scatter once. Okay. So that's how you can distinguish between neutrons and WIMPs. And this is the entry here to the Sudan mine. Now, as absorber in CDMS, we have germanium or silicon crystals. They are 1 centimeter thick here and 7.5 centimeters in diameter. And this temperature sensor, or this transitional sensor, are photographically patterned thin films of aluminum and tungsten. Okay, on the surface, you can see them here. They're the tungsten. These are the transitional sensor, about 1 micron or so. So what we do, we measure ionization in a very low field, a few volts per centimeter, with segmented electrodes. So you basically have an inner and an outer electrode to allow you to discriminate against the background that comes from the edges of your crystals. And you also have 4 phono sensors that I will show you why that's helping to have 4 instead of 1. So first of all, background discrimination. Okay. Now, this is what we want to measure, the recoil energy, and what I plotted here is the what we call ionization yield. So this is the ionization energy that you measure in one of your channels, okay, divided by the total energy, which is given by the phonon energy, okay? And by calibrating your experiment with known sources, in here photon sources, for instance, or neutron sources, you can define where your background region is. So your background region is up here, and this is your signal region, because you calibrate for a WIMP interaction with neutrons. Okay, these neutrons give you, as I said, nuclear recoils. Okay, so basically you use this ionization yield to do a cut, as I'll show you later. However, there's a slight problem here, namely some of the events, namely electrons, that interact in a very shallow layer of your detector, which is also called the dead layer, because of some of the charge will actually go into the wrong electrode. That means you don't collect the entire charge for that event. Okay, so some of the interactions that should be here at the y equal 1 will drop, okay, into your signal region. So once you got rid of all the neutrons, these events are actually your background, and I'll show you how we can get rid of those. Namely, by looking at the timing of the events. Okay, so I said we have 2 ionization signals. This is one of them here. That's very fast. And then we have the 4 phonon signals. Okay, from the 4 quadrants. And if you look at the timing, at the delay, for instance, between the ionization and the signal in the quadrant where the interaction happened, that gives you the highest signal here, the highest phonon signal. And also, if you look at the rise time of the signal, then you can discriminate against events that actually happen on the surface and events that are in the bulk of your detector. Okay. So what I'm plotting here is now ionization yield. This was before on the y-axis. Okay. And this is this timing parameter. That's the phonon delay. Okay. So you remember this? There was a band here. If you plot this versus energy of gammas, neutrons, and then these events. Okay. That go into your signal region. However, all these have, if you look at the timing parameters, then all these have very short delays or rise times, okay, because they happen at the surface. So you do a cut okay, you do a wide cut, so a typical cut would be this here, you do a wide cut, and you do also cut in your climbing parameter, and then you keep here most of the signal while discriminating against all of your background. And these effectors, if you use the ionization yield alone, they reject more than actually 99.9% of your gammas. And if you use the phonon timing as well, then you get rid of virtually all the gammas and most of the betas. Betas, we call these electrons that interact with the surface. Okay. Now, CDMS2 at Sudan, we have now five towers. I'll show you what a tower is. A tower is just a structure that has six detectors with its called electronics. Okay. So we have five of these installed in what we call the icebox or the cryostat. And some people, of course, I cannot scare you off here with these type of images, but some people are asking, why do you actually even go underground, and why do you need a dilute refrigerator when it mostly looks like that in northern Minnesota? So we have a total of about 5 kilograms of germanium and 1 kilogram of silicon detectors. Okay, so that's very recent. We haven't actually started that run. The data I'm going to show you are from two towers, and these are just some images. This is the dilute refrigerator, and this is what I showed you before. So these towers are in here, and then you have layers of shield. Okay, so you need to shield, even though you have a good discrimination, you want to shield as much as possible against all these backgrounds, gammas, electrons, neutrons. So you have intervening here layers of lead that shield against gammas, of course, and polyethylene for the neutrons. And then, of course, you surround your experiment by this shield, you close everything up, and then on the outside, I'm not showing you a picture, you have a muon detector. Because the only particles, the only cosmic rays that actually make it to, through the Earth, say, through the 2,000 meter watt equivalent, are muons. And these muons can create fast neutrons in your shield. So you want the high efficiency muon detector surrounding your detector. Okay? Now, the first runs at Sudan, we had one tower between October 2003 and January 2004, about 22 kilogram days germanium exposure. And then a second run later in 2004 here with two towers where we had accumulated 38 kilogram days of exposure also in germanium. So obviously I've shown you that the cross-section scales say roughly like a square, so you will ask, well, why do you actually use silicon at all? You know, because it doesn't make sense. Germanium is much heavier. But as I said, it serves as a cross-check that when you actually see a signal, the event rate in silicon should be much lower. But if you actually measure neutrons in your germanium, then the event rate in silicon will be the same, okay, or a little bit higher, in fact. Now, this is the wind search data. So it's all the data there is. And again, this ionization yield versus recoil energy, okay. We have most of our background is up here. We do have these events that scatter more or less off the surface. However, after you do the timing cuts that I've shown you, we are left only with one candidate. Okay. Again, these regions are very well defined with calibration sources, and we take, I don't know, hundreds of times more data than we actually expect here from the background to do these calibrations. Okay, so we have one wind candidate with a recoil energy here at 10.5 kV. However, before you get too excited that it's a dark matter, it's perfectly okay with the expected background. Okay, and in fact, in the afterwards, we have seen that this event happened in one detector that had a really bad day. Okay. So in the hindsight, our cuts to get rid of bad data, if you want, weren't good enough. So it was a day where all the events in that detector were not, or most of them were not here, but were somewhere here. Okay, so it didn't work very well. But anyway, so we are pretty sure it's not a wind. But even so, it agrees with our estimated systematic error.
Just a question. So
right.
This is about these detections, claim detections.
No.
Okay. No, it's not.
Oh, okay.
The question I'm asking about is Italian detection. Do you think that they actually just underestimated the error bar, the systematic error bar? As a result, they got this 3 sigma potential.
Oh, they say they have more than 6 sigma.
6 sigma.
I showed you the 3 sigma evidence region, but they say they have a 6. No, that's actually very hard. I will show you through if you have time afterwards on plot. But they do, you know, the way they claim they see a signal is by saying that they see what you expect. I'm not talking about it, this annual modulation of your event rate, okay? Because of the sun and the earth move in a galactic halo, so expect your event rate to modulate with the season. And they do see a modulation. Now, the question is, where does it come from? Okay, everything modulates with the seasons, as you know, the whatever, the snow on the mountain modulates with the season. However, they claim that they have checked all kinds of systematic effects. Okay, the muon flux varies with they say all the systematic effects they have checked are way too small to explain their signal. That's what they say. However, they do not release the data. You know, so nobody can actually do an independent analysis. And there are many where, I mean, we can come to that, but there are many where, there are many questions, if you want, that they don't answer, okay, for some reason, although they make a very, very strong claim. So, okay, so as you have seen this before, this was our old result, and this was the new one. This is, again, Zeppelin and Edelweiss. Now, these were for spin-independent interactions. It turns out that CDMS, although it is not mainly made of nuclei with spin, has some sensitivity to spin interactions as well. Why is that? Because natural germanium contains 73 germanium with spin 9.5, only about 7.7%, and also natural silicon has 29 silicon spin here, -1/2, that's about 4.7 or so percent. Both are single unpaired neutrons, so for poor neutron coupling, this is just a way of presenting the results, okay? So that you can actually compare different experiments. You say, okay, in this case, you have a poor neutron coupling, so the coupling to protons, you set 0, while in this case, you set the coupling to neutrons 0, and you would have a pure proton coupling, okay? And if now gamma, because people have tried to interpret this gamma signal as coming from a blimp that only interacts via spin. Okay? However, if that's the case, this is where gamma, this is the pink region here, is the prediction, and this is now excluded by the CDMS, this is the germanium data, and by the silicon data for pure neutron coupling. For pure proton coupling, CDMS is not as good because, as I said, you have here a single unpaired neutron, but there are other experiments, NIAID, and I see Picasso is actually not here, but Picasso has a limit here that actually improves the NIAID limit at low energies, okay? So it's very similar. And then there's indirect detection. We're going to talk about that super K. So there is a window here for gamma at very low masses, but I think it's artificial because this cut here is due to the threshold of super K. Okay, if these WIMPs interact mostly via proton, we have spin interaction on protons, that they should accumulate in the sun, and Super Kamiokande should see a signal from WIMP annihilation in the sun. Okay, and I'll show you their data, and that's not the case, they don't see anything. Okay, and the threshold, they have a, you know, a certain energy threshold in their experiment, that's I think a few MeV or so they cannot go below that. Now the plan for CDMS, as I said, we have now 5 of these towers, and we want to start taking data pretty soon, hopefully in the next month or so, and to measure, at least to take data over another year, that would bring us from where we are now here to this region, so it would increase by a factor of 10. But as mentioned already, the predicted parameter space here is more or less bottomless. It can go down to cross-section of 10 to the minus 48 or so. Okay. So what we need much, much larger experiments to drastically improve this, okay? So what I showed you, this corresponded to about 1 event per kilogram day. This here, where CDMS is now, corresponds to about 0.1 events per kilogram day. That's the sensitivity of these experiments. We want to go to 1 event per kilogram year, or maybe 1 event per 100 kilogram year in future projects, okay? So to detect, to have any statistics, let's say that the cross-section is 10 to the minus 46 square centimeters, then you need 1 ton to detect 10 events in 1 year. Okay. So So you want to go to ton or multi-ton experiments, and what a surprise, right? I mean, the neutrino cross-sections are larger, yet we have experiments that are kiloton experiments to see these neutrinos, right? So I won't talk about all these projects, let's see how much time I have, but there are many, many proposed projects, and some of them are now in the phase of construction or commissioning. So there's Super CDMS that is just based on CDMS technology and wants to build up a ton of these CDMS detectors, most likely at SNOWLAB. It would be a phased approach, namely 25 kilograms, 150, and then a ton. Okay. So there was a proposal, however, the agencies are not willing even to talk about a ton, so they're only willing to talk about 25 kilograms. At this point, there's a European effort that's called Eureka that will join two European experiments that are also cryogenic, namely CREST and Edelweiss. And I'm not sure, I don't think they know where it's going to be located, but most likely in Sasso. There's Zeppelin Max and Xenon. These are experiments based on liquid xenon, and I'm going to talk about one of them, namely. So far, we looked at phonon and charge. What they do is looking at charge and light, okay, to discriminate against background. And the plan is also to go to a ton here. One of them will be in the movie mine, the other one in Gran Sasso. There's one single experiment that attempts to detect the direction of the incoming wind. Okay, so if you would have the direction, that would be a very, very strong signature, right, of the order of 10% or more, right? Because we are moving, the Earth is actually moving into the sea of winds. Okay. And depending on where the Earth is, they will come from a different direction. So you predict actually a diurnal variation in your signal. Right? However, to measure the direction of the incoming wind, you need something that's a gas, because otherwise we won't have any tracks. Okay, you need to measure the direction of the recoil, and that's then connected to the direction of the incoming wind. But in all the detectors we have discussed so far, you cannot actually measure that. However, if you have a gas and you have a very, you know, the density of your detector is low, so your event rate will go down. But anyway, there is such an attempt to go to 100 kilograms of a large, or very large TPC at the Bobby mine. The proposal to build liquid argon experiments, these are very similar to the liquid xenon that we are going to talk about. And there are also some proposals to use superheated droplets. One of them is Picasso, for instance, that's Sudbury right now. They have now a few grams of these fluorocarbons, and the detection of winds is on 19 fluorine that has spin. And what in the near future they plan to go to 1 kilogram or so. Okay, these are these mini bubble chambers that have about 100 microns diameter. Right. So superheated droplets means that you have say these mini bubble chambers in a gel or something, and then a particle comes, deposits a critical energy in there, and then you have a phase transition. Okay. So if you want, your bubble explodes, and you can hear that. You know, you have piezoelectric transducers to actually measure that. And when this phase transition happens, actually depends on the pressure, on the temperature, and also on dE over dx. Okay, and by adjusting the pressure and the temperature, they can make that experiment to be to look only for nuclear recoils and to be totally insensitive to electron recoils, for example, to background. Okay. But their background, their main background, will also be neutrons, and also so currently it's alpha decays. Okay, so it's a well-established technique, and at some point they probably will be able to go to much larger masses. There's another one that's called COOP that's now at Fermilab. So let me just talk very briefly about liquid xenon, because that seems to be a very promising technology to go to very large detector masses in the near future. Okay. Why is it favorable? Well, it has this high atomic mass, high atomic number and density. That means you can build a compact detector, reasonable cost, easy cryogenics if you compare to CDMS. It operates only at minus 100 Celsius. but not at millikelvin. Okay, so pulling a tone to millikelvin obviously is a larger challenge, but it can be done. You have no longer the radioactive xenon, and you can purify it. You have a high photon and charge yield, and you have isotopes with and without spin. Now, what are the basic processes? So, as I said, you're looking for charge at light. Okay, so you have excitation here, and then what you produce in the end, you produce photons, 175 nanometers, and a triplet and a singlet here, but they are very close in time. And then you also produce free electrons that, if nothing happens, they will just recombine and then give you, you know, a secondary light signal if you want. Now, again, this, if you call this the primary light signal or S1, and this one as two, or the secondary one, okay, the ratio of the two will be very dependent whether you have a nuclear recoil here or an electron recoil. Okay, for electron recoil, you have a very good charge collection, say if you collect the charge, while for nuclear recoil, you have strong recombinations. So how do you build a detector? Well, it turns out you need a two-phase detector. So say you have a liquid phase here and then a gas phase up here, and why is that the case? Well, as I said, WIMPs or neutrons, these are slow nuclear recoils, you have a strong recombination, and the ionization will be strongly suppressed. Okay. But you have some ionization, the problem is that you cannot detect it directly. So what you want to do is you want to extract the charge from here into the gas phase. So you apply a field, extract the charge, apply another field here to amplify it, and then you will detect the secondary light signal, because these charges will induce what's called electroluminescence. They will collide with other xenon atoms, excite them, and so on. Okay? So you will see a secondary light signal that's delayed by whatever, 5 microseconds, depending, of course, on your detector. Now, the challenge here, you have to have an ultra-pure liquid, because otherwise, if you have some electronegative impurities in there, they will eat up all your electrons, and you won't see a secondary signal at all. Okay, you need to extract these few electrons, these few photons, and so on, that are associated with a very low energy threshold. So there's not a problem. You know, detectors like this have been used in high energy physics. However, you're dealing here with very very small energy depositions, and what you want is not just to detect this energy, but to have good discrimination at very low energy. So that's the challenge. Now, this Zeno proposal has a modular design of building a one-ton xenon target into distributed in an array of 10 TPCs. R&D has been funded by NSF, and what we're doing now is constructing the first 10-kilogram experiment that's going to go to Gran Sasso, hopefully in February. That will do some physics on its own, but also pave the way for the first 100-kilogram module that should be ready for data taking by the end of 2007. And the goal is to reach these type of cross-sections. Okay, and to show you just some pictures. Well, this is the innermost part of your chamber. You have these field-shaping rings there. The structure is always made of Teflon because it's highly reflective for xenon light. You have an array of PMTs and so on, to detect the light. Now, just one or two slides to show rough comparison, if you want, of direct detection and the reach of accelerators. So I've shown you this plot here, cross section versus mass. Now, of course, to set any limits from accelerators, you need a particle physics model, okay? So in a certain model, if you want, M subra or so, then this region here, everything that's left of, I don't know what is, 50 or so GB is already excluded by accelerators, okay? This would be here the LHC reach, right? And then this would be the ILC reach or so. So as you can see, why is that? Because you have somewhat of a 2 dB limit here at LHC for guinos, quarks, and sleptons. And roughly, the mass of the neutralino is a sixth of that. So you have, in most supersymmetric model, you have a 300 dB or so limit. Okay. However, as probably some of you know, there are lots of papers out there stating that LHC will have a very hard time identifying the nature of a dark matter candidate. So you need a more precise measurement that could be given by the ILC. Okay. Now, the direct detections, obviously, these experiments are cross-section limited. It's very hard, but it's not impossible, to go to lower cross-section. However, we are not limited in mass. So eventually, these experiments can look at higher masses than are accessible by accelerators. So they are complementary, of course. And this is just this is just to show you. This is a typical region in the M-Sugrad space that has been used a lot as a so-called benchmark model. Okay, so these green regions here are compatible, if you want, with a WMAP. They give you relic densities of the neutralinos that are compatible, and then you take your certain points. So the region have been named, like rapid annihilation final, annihilation tail, and so on. But you can take points in these regions and then see how well would LHC or ILC or the direct detection experiments do in terms of measuring, for instance, the cross-section of such a particle. Okay? And this is here a study that's been done by these people. It looks at the probability density of measuring this cross-section. Okay, so this is what LHC would do, as you can see, would measure it very well. LHC plus ILC 500, and this would be here the spike, this ILC should be dealt with on LHC plus ILC 1000, okay? And this is what CDMS to 25 kilograms would do, and LHC together. Okay. So let me see, as I explained, direct detection experiments, they always, they look at cross-section, if you want, times density in the halo. Okay, the density is not a number that we know. It has an uncertainty of a factor of 2 or 3, right? So to get a good number from direct detection experiments on the cross section or on the density, you need to know at least one of them from some other measurement. Now, how does it look for universal extra dimensions? There you have fewer parameters, okay? So most of the time you have a three parameter, say the mass of your dark matter candidate. Another three parameter is the mass splitting between the Kaluza-Klein quark, and here the dark matter candidate is the Kaluza-Klein partner of the photon, okay? And another three parameter that you have to make some assumption is on the Higgs mass also. Now, if you take this mass splitting here as a free parameter and plot this versus the mass of your WIMP, you can translate the limits that I've shown you before from direct detection experiments into this plane. Okay, so what does maybe you concentrate here on this blue line? So everything that's left of it has been already excluded by CDMF 2005. Okay. If you would have, say, a splitting that's somewhere, I don't know, here, and the mass at 300 dB or so, then CDMS would have seen something. And what's right of this red line has been excluded by WMAP. So this is 100%. So this line is where a dark matter candidate would provide, say, 100% of the dark matter there is. Okay. So what I want to show here is that, for instance, a xenon one-cone experiment could cover most of this predicted or the parameter space that's left, and super CDMS one-cone would do even better. Okay, so let's see how much time do I have? 15 minutes or 10?
5.
Okay.
10.
Right. So then very briefly, let's go to indirect detection. As I said, you want to observe here the radiation that's produced in dark matter annihilation. The flux here is proportional to the cross-section squared, so that enters, that's even more important here, annihilation cross-section, and 1 over mass squared. So you want to look at these high-density regions, and what are those galactic halo at center, and also in the Sun and Earth core, okay? So WIMPs will annihilate into all kinds of particles and produce, say, positrons, electrons, protons, antiprotons, and so on. And what we want to look for is an excess of such particles above, say, the known background. And you have a background that's smaller, for instance, if you look at antiprotons or positrons, or so that if you would be looking at protons, right? You can also look for gammas, and diffuse, a diffuser spectrum coming from these decays here, mostly from ion decays, or this process is suppressed, but still you could get the gamma line. Okay. Again, you have these particle physics parameters here. You have the dark halo. So the profile would be very important because you have the square here, and you also need to know the propagation of these particles in the galaxy. Okay. Now, gamma ray detection, as you I'm sure know, you have these ground-based telescopes that direct the Cherenkov light in the atmosphere, like HESS, MAGIC, Kangaroo, Veritas, and so on. And you also have space-based telescopes, okay? IGRE that took data over 9 years or so, and the next one is scheduled to be launched in 2007, that's GLASS. Now, one region of great interest is the galactic center. And the galactic center has been observed by several experiments here, and as an excess of gamma ray, an excess of gamma rays has been seen. However, the spatial resolution of these experiments wasn't that great. And so this is a plot before HESS. And then after HESS, as you can see here, this was greatly improved, okay? So it seems that the excess that they see coincides with coordinates here of Sagittarius A, more or less.
Is that the galactic center?
Right, that's where the black hole. Now, there are many explanations, if you want very mundane explanation of this excess that's observed. All these explanations have to do with acceleration processes associated with a supermassive black hole. Okay? However, the signal has also been interpreted here in this paper as evidence, if you want, for dark matter. Okay? So this is here their energy, their spectrum, and this is what they measure. And this cannot be explained, they say, by any, standard processes. And they say they can fit this if they assume a WIMP mass here of 80 TeV. And they can do the same game with the Kangaroo data. As you can see, the Kangaroo data doesn't really agree with HESS. But anyway, they can fit it assuming a 1.1 TeV mass. So on the other side, IGRET measured the diffuse gamma ray sky. Okay. And discovered many sources, and most of them are yet unidentified. And IGRET data, very high resolution data, is available. You can download it and analyze it. And some people here that wrote this paper, the Boer et al., have reanalyzed the data if you want. And what they claim is that they see evidence for dark matter annihilation. Okay. Now, this diffuse component, this is the data, okay, the blue points here, this is what's measured, and they claim they can calculate the background pretty well. That's all the yellow region here that comes from normal processes, if you want, involving protons and so on, like ion decay, Bremsstrahlung, and inverse Compton. And no matter how they tweak the parameters, they cannot explain the entire signal here unless they assume another component, namely here a WIMP with a mass between 50 to 70 GeV. And what they do, they look at 180 different regions of the sky, okay? They say this is equivalent to doing 180 different accelerator experiments, and they claim that they can fit all these regions by assuming basically the same background and the same WIMP mass. And they go even further and say that they can actually reproduce the rotation curve of our galaxy, and they see some ring-like structures and so on. So we can talk later about that if you're interested. But anyway, just to show you in terms of direct detection, if that's the case, if this excess of gamma rays really comes from WIMP annihilation, then the region would be somewhere here, okay? So, and this is where CDMS is. So the good news is that we could see it maybe if it's there next year. So if CDMS doesn't see this, then there's a problem, okay? Now, as I said, you can also look for WIMP annihilation in the sun or in the Earth. So WIMPs will scatter with nuclei. As I said, the probability is not high, but it's not zero. And if you wait long enough, eventually their velocity will fall below the escape velocity, they will settle to the core, and they start to annihilate. Okay. Now, from all the other particles only neutrinos can escape, and we detect that in these neutrino telescopes. And how do you detect them? Well, you have these charge current interactions that are produced below your detector, so you of mu neutrinos, and then you create a muon that leaves, that creates this Cherenkov cone. For instance, if it moves through water or ice, that you can then detect with photomultipliers. So we have some underground detectors like macro and super Kamiokande that have limits on these muon fluxes coming from the sun or the earth. And there's the Amanda experiment, the Baikal, Antares is being built, as well as Nestor, Nemo, IceCube, and KM3Net. Also look for neutrinos coming from neutrino annihilation, but also from other high energy sources of neutrinos. However, so far, no experiment has seen any excess above the atmospheric neutrino background. And the best limits come from the super Kamiokande. So what they look for an excess of number of these upwards through-going muons in their detector. Okay, they can look in all regions of the sky, and of course, if they expect a signal from the Earth, then the signal would come from here, or on the other side from the sun, they would expect the signal coming from this region. Okay, if this is the angular distribution here of these upward-going muons with respect to the sun. However, they don't see any excess, and they only give limits. So this is a busy plot. This is just a muon flux coming from the sun here as a function of the neutralino mass, and the same for the Earth. And this is the magenta here is the super K limit. Okay, this is the Amanda limit. It's better actually if you come from the Earth. And just to relate this again to the direct searches, how does this compare to direct detect experiments? The green points here have already been excluded by the old CDMS data. There hasn't been an update after CDMS 2005. So you would have this region actually going down here, and for the Earth, they're actually not really competitive. So this is a summary that I hopefully made clear. There is a complementarity between these different approaches. Now, what is the goal of direct detect experiments is to hopefully discover such a relic particle and then constrain this parameter space here, okay, mass, and here cross sections times flux or density in the halo. And with input from LHC, ILC on the mass and cross section, we could determine what is the local density. In direct detection, again, discover relic particles, you would constrain M squared, then cross sections times sigma over the integral of the line of sight. Okay, you look for the annihilation, so you have rho squared there. With input from accelerators, you could determine the density and hopefully the distribution of dark matter, perhaps in the galactic center, that's very interesting, or in the halo. And here, of course, you'd like to determine a physics model if you discover something and predict these cross sections. So it's a very exciting field. There are many ideas, many experiments. The good news is that 10 to the minus 7 picobar levels have been reached for the first time. These are very, very small cross sections. Okay? And we are testing some supersymmetry and UAV models, and perhaps other models that you have in mind that we just haven't made a plot yet, if they give us a win candidate. Indirect detections, I haven't shown you some, there are some other possible signals. If you look at positrons or antiprotons and so on, so there are several signals out there that we don't know if they're really true, with masses between 60 GeV and 18 keV. However, in this case, because rho squared is entered in your equations, the astrophysical uncertainties are much higher. Okay, hopefully we will get the microscopic properties of these particles, and the goal will be then to study the distribution of dark matter in the galaxy and finally understand how it formed. And then also in conjunction with embodied simulation, if you want to study structural formation. So that's all it. Thank you.
Okay, questions?
There has been this rumor that a few galaxies have been found that seem to have little or no dark matter. Has this rumor gone away? Or are there such galaxies?
That have little or no dark matter.
So that the yes. rotation curves just don't need.
Right. Well, I'm actually not sure what happened to those. Yeah. But you see, we have these other, we have this low, I mean, you're not talking about a low surface brightness galaxies, because there are lots of galaxies that seem to be completely dominated by dark matter, for instance.
I meant the opposite.
The opposite. I don't know, yeah, I don't know how many of these are, what's happened. One? Yeah.
One candidate of dark kinds of galaxies is very diffusing. I said there are 12 galaxies which consist mainly of neutral gas, hydrogen gas. This could be one of those. Also, it could be gas flowing in from a nearby galaxy. So, I'm not ready to think that there.
I'm asking because the significance of that would be, of course, that you'll be in trouble for those who, for those theories which try to explain radar effect, basically saying it's a change of the laws of gravity.
Right, that's true. I mean, as I said, we have, I don't think that you have any galaxies without any dark matter, but if you map, say, more than 1,000 galaxies or so, you can actually explain all their rotation curves in terms of a lot or few dark matter, depending on their luminosity, okay? Mm-hmm. I don't know about this one, what happened to it, or how good the evidence is for no dark matter at all.
Search done by a woman physicist in Australia, did extensive search of discovered that it's been published.
What about axions?
Right, we are talking about. Well, axions are a perfectly viable dark matter candidate.
But the window is pretty small.
Well, the window is small, but it's not, they haven't covered yet the entire region that's been, you know, that's predicted by theories. So there is, I think the best experiment is the Florida Livermore experiment that's at the Lawrence Livermore lab. And they, I don't know how much you know about it, but anyway, they, you know, they are taking data, they are looking also for this high-res signal, if you want. Fikibi, he predicts these caustics, okay, and if you would have that, you would have, of course, an enhancement there, so they're looking for, but they haven't seen anything yet.
What if you keep going down in the cross-section, and you don't see any, what's the smallest cross-section?
Well, I mean, that depends a lot on your theory, okay? So for universal extra dimensions, there's a limit because the contribution to the WIMPs, say, scattering of force comes, they interfere constructively, okay? You can have Higgs exchange or you can have a Kaluza-Klein quark exchange and so on. So there's a bottom. For supersymmetry, it depends, of course, a lot where you set your cutoff scale, right? I mean, you can go down, if you want to make your masses, the masses of your superpartners of the exchange are very heavy, then the cross-sections will go down, but then there's no point of supersymmetry actually solving the problems of the standard model.
So I was going to ask that question. So if you
right.
assume that supersymmetry naturally solves a hierarchy problem, so we're pretty close to an upper mass limit, supersymmetry Bragg scale or Higgs scale.
Right.
If we constrain the supersymmetric standard model parameters by that cut, does that have an implication for your cross section versus mass?
Well, it depends on, yeah, you can, you know, it could be 10 to the minus 48 or so squares, but it depends, again, on the additional assumptions you make. So some people, if you relax, well, what additional assumptions do you make, right? Because, as you know, it has 105-3 parameters, and then do you assume unification of certain parameters as the gut scale, or do you have a phenomenological model where you set all your parameters at the weak scale, and so on and so forth. So I haven't seen, you know, I haven't seen any paper saying, okay, this is the lowest cross section, and there's nothing below that. Okay. But however, I think if you make such a naturalness argument, you go to somewhere 10 to the minus 48, 10 to the minus 50, or so even.
Where's that picture?
Right. So that's let's go maybe back to the Ellis calculation. So, as you can see, this is here 10 to the minus 48. And depending now, if you take this constrained MSSM by Ellis et al., okay, you end somewhere here.
That's the red cross.
These are the red cross are this benchmark point, but this is the blue region here. Okay. If you take more unconstrained, if you want MSSM here by Balton Gondolo, I don't even know where they stop, but I believe somewhere around 10 to the minus 50. And this is where CDMS one ton will go. But you see now, with the LHC being so close, people start to study this in a little bit more detail, okay? And look at these, you know, take these benchmark points and look what would be the implications and so on and so forth. But everything's based on, on some arguments that in the end you ask yourself, do they make sense or we don't know.
But what about the practical? How low can you go before you hit noise?
Well, how low can you go before you hit neutrinos, say, or so? You know, I think it's for another order of magnitude here, but I mean, what do you mean by noise? You know, I mean, we are here now, basically. How far can you go before you get background limited? Right. This depends a lot on how well you know and how well you can. You know, you can build a zero background experiment if you're good enough, and that's what these experiments in the end need to be.
It's becoming like. It's a more experiment looking
for ether. Yeah, it's becoming more and more difficult.
It's a more experiment.
Nice.
Do these models also predict the density of these relic particles? I mean, it's one thing to calculate what the cross is.
Oh, no, they don't predict the density.
The density is completely free. So.
Right. I mean, so when you look at They mostly look at what is compatible with WMAPs. So what is compatible with a range of relic densities, not the density in the halo, but a relic density, right? So because you don't want to predict a particle in these models, say a mass in a cross section that that gives you a relic density that's whatever 20 or so. So, but they use cosmology to constrain their parameter space, these models, okay? And what you see here is already constrained by WMAP. And by all the accelerator searches, and so on. So they don't predict it.
So just follow up on that. So you could even find a dark matter particle that's not the dominant.
Right.
So it could be the only zero, basically.
You could have axions and WIMPs and or several WIMPs and stuff like that. Exactly. If omega, the relic density, say, is smaller than 0.23 or so, then the question is also, how is the local density, right?
But these detectors you described don't detect axions anyway, so...
These don't detect, there are other detectors for axions, yeah. But you could have, there are papers that are showing you can have a subdominant population. And up to, depending on how subdominant is, you can still have good chances of seeing it.
Right, because of course you are in the over density.
Right. But you don't really know.
So it would be nice to actually put on these plots exactly then, you know, where this would be the main thing for structural formation. Where exactly for in this space, you get the relevant things for structural formation and focus models.
Well, actually, all the space that's that's allowed by this, but you mean, let's see, what do you mean, in terms of,
where would you get 93%?
Yeah. Right. Okay, yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, so you would have some contour line. I mean, similar to the plot that we made for UAV, where you actually, I know what you mean, yeah. Where is it? Where we actually have the contours of how much it would give you in terms of the relic density, right? So here, for example, this is a 100% line, and this is here a 10% line, and this is a 1% or so, yeah. So yeah, you can do something similar for it. It just hasn't been done, I guess. Yeah. That's a good point.
Any other questions? Okay, let's thank Laura. Laura is just here for the rest of today, but she's around for the people's conference. Thank you.